Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started.
So I said in the last lecture that the assignment would be due at the end of today. I instead made it due at the end of tomorrow. So the end of Saturday. The next assignment should come out by tomorrow. I might have it. I think I'll have it partially done today, but I don't think I'll have it done tomorrow. The tutorial today
is going to be very heavily based off the textbook, but if you need to, you can spend some time in tutorial also working on the homework. If you have further questions, be able to do that. So that, as long as you come to tutorial and spend time there, that's fine. And if in fact you have the Monday tutorial, you can instead come Friday, because Friday is always a small tutorial. So come on Friday, get help with your homework. And also, you will notice in the
on the course outline, I have on the list of readings, I've changed the order of the readings. The readings for today are not on TLBs and more in virtual memory. Instead, it's on concurrency and locks. And the reason I did that is because I realized I only have one more tutorial for you guys before the midterm, because my next tutorial is being gotten rid of by well, I can't have a required tutorial the following weekend because there's Thanksgiving. So I realized the last tutorial I wanted to do for you all before the midterm was on concurrency, so that's what the tutorial today is.
So I figured before I have a tutorial on concurrency, I should probably talk to you a bit about concurrency. So that's what we're doing today.
So any questions before I continue this? I'm just bringing up something so I don't forget about it. Let's look at chapter. Okay, so have you ever coded anything that was multi-threaded? Have you done multi-threaded programs yet in any of your classes?
Yes.
Which class?
2401.
Okay, 2401, you did do P-threads?
Different
2401. Yeah. I expected some of you might have seen some threads, but you wouldn't necessarily know so much about it. So
the key problem we're talking about today is concurrency.
So when we say concurrency, we're talking about more than one thing happening at a time inside, typically inside of a computer. Well, you can talk about concurrency at any context, but here we're talking about computer systems. Now, the thing that messes people up about concurrency is that you're not taught to think in concurrent terms when you first learn to program. When you first learn to program, you think of a computer doing one thing, then doing another thing, and then doing another thing, and that's your model of computation. But that's not how computers work in practice. That is an abstraction that applies in many contexts, but in other contexts it does not. More than one thing can happen at the same time for multiple reasons. One is because we have multi-core systems. Since we have multi-core systems, we have more than one processor that are both accessing the same shared bank of memory, same RAM, and also the same other I/O devices, videos, this, whatever. So, since you have more than one core, they are all. What's the point of having more than one core if they can't run at the same time? They have to share. They have to interact. That's a concurrent system. The other is interrupts. So even if you have one processor, you still have concurrency issues because you have interrupts. The CPU can be interrupted at any point in its execution and told to do something else. And if that something else involves accessing shared data structures, you get exactly the same problems as if you have a multi-core system. On older systems, you could actually deal with a lot of concurrency problems where you had to deal with, you didn't want something else interfering with you by turning off interrupts. But in general now, that doesn't really help you because we're in the multi-core world. So
if you solve it in the multi-core case, you normally take care of the interrupt case.
So I'm not going to talk too much about more about that. There's a bit about in the book about interrupts as an early form, but not quite that.
So in the context of how we've been talking about operating systems and talking about the abstractions that it provides, saying that we have these multiple address spaces where each address space goes to a different process, how does this, when we talk about concurrency, what are we talking about in there?
Talking about timeout.
So there's in virtual memory. And in
so when I talk about concurrency issues in virtual memory, I'm talking about things that arise in an execution context in which you're executing things in a virtual address space. What am I really talking about?
This is multi-threaded process.
Talking about multi-threaded process here in physical memory.
Who has to deal with that problem? Who has to deal with physical memory? The operator.
So multi-threaded processes, so conceptually the issues that come up are essentially the same in both of these, but the mechanisms are different. Because of course, when you're in the OS context, you have access to full resources of the system. When you're in a when you're running a regular process, you don't have access to the full resources. The OS has full resources. You've been given access to a small subset of them. So you don't have access to everything, so potentially that means maybe the problems you have to deal with aren't so big. Who has to deal with interrupts? CPU runs everything. The CPU's already running. So interrupts.
Here.
Is there anything equivalent to interrupts
for regular processing?
Signal.
Exactly.
The best way to think about signals. There's a funny way, but signals are an interrupt-like mechanism for processing. The operating system monopolizes all the interrupts. They're the one. It's the one that controls. It controls the code that runs when you press a key on your keyboard, when data comes in from the disk, when network packets come in.
The operating system is the one that has to manage that, but individual processes also need to know similar kinds of things. Like they need to know, has a file I've been observing, has anything happened to it? Has the user typed a key? Has there been something happened on the network? So has one of my children died? So signals are interrupts for a regular process. They're not the only mechanism though, because you can also have There's various kinds of asynchronous I/O that you can do inside of a process where you might be waiting or you might not be waiting and you check on things and stuff. So that's where you're going to see concurrency issues also. But the basic real problem of things is not about I/O events, not about interrupts and stuff. It's about memory. That's the pain of concurrency. The pain of concurrency is we've got an address space of some kind. It could be your physical address space. It could be your virtual address space. It doesn't really matter because what's happening is you've got multiple zeros, one. They are executing code at different places in the same address space. And they're accessing data in different parts or same parts of that same address space. That's the problem. Well, that locking is how you potentially solve this. But locking is you, the programmer, saying how to control mutual exclusion. That's when we say mutual exclusion, it usually means that whatever CPU 0 is messing with, you want to make sure that CPU 1 is it, and CPU 2 is it. You want to make sure only one processor is messing with mutual exclusion. One CPU in one CPU in a critical section at a time. So when I say it, so that's the critical section. If you're thinking of the CPU counter, you know, the CPU is going along and executing things, doing things inside the address space. It's a big address space. Most of the time, if you organize things right, they're just going to go about their business and they won't interfere with each other. So when they're not going to interfere with each other, you let them do whatever they're going to do. But when they're going to potentially interact with each other, access some sort of shared code and data, that's where you want to make sure that they aren't doing that at the same time. Because that's where it becomes very difficult to reason about what would happen. So we define that section where we can run into concurrency issues as critical sections. And to deal with critical sections, we use mutual exclusion mechanisms to make sure only, basically to make it serial, to make it one at a time inside of that critical section. So the way you do this in terms of code is you have your lines of code, and we'll define, say, okay, this part of the code is critical. So what we need in some in a critical section is here, enforce mutual exclusion here, and then here, relax. Now, why not enforce mutual exclusion all the time? These have a lot of work to do with, you know, all these little places all over the place. What's this? I'm just saying it's N. You know, enforce this, you don't stop enforcing it.
Mm-hmm. It's rare that you're going to want to change the same data at the same time.
Right, but if it's so dangerous that if it's so dangerous that you're going to cause problems if you get into the section, and we might forget to say, oh, enforce mutual exclusion, why don't I just do it all the time?
Exactly. Because if you do that, you're only running one CPU. Enforcing mutual exclusion all the time, you might as well not have those other cores. Just throw them away. And in fact, if you look at older systems, when they tried to enforce mutual exclusion, they typically did something kind of like this. So when I say enforce mutual exclusion, what I really mean is grab locks. And here I'm saying release locks.
Now you could have, so I'll explain what I mean by a lock is exactly, but you can think of a lock as just something that's just going to make sure that you have exclusive control of this, and when you let go of it, you don't have exclusive control. So how many locks do you have? How long, what do the locks cover? 8. To maximize parallelism, you would have lots and lots of locks. Because then you would just grab the ones that you need, and if you didn't need, you need other locks, then you would keep running. But the more locks you have, of course, the more bookkeeping you have to keep track of, and the more mistakes you can make. So older versions of the Linux kernel, when they first ported, in fact, this is true for basically every operating system kernel, when it gets ported from running on one CPU to running on multiple CPUs, they typically go from one CPU first to two CPUs. And when they go to two CPUs, the mutual exclusion they enforce on the kernel is simple. They have one lock. They have a global lock for the kernel. And so what effectively this means is the kernel runs in a single-threaded fashion. It can only run on one CPU at a time. So if you have two processors, you'd have both of them running, but if one of them's running the kernel, the other one is not running the kernel. It's running a regular user space process. So both CPU can run user space, only one processor can run the kernel at a time. Simple to program. When you enter the kernel, you grab the global lock. When you exit the kernel, when you finish with your system call, you release the global lock. You never have to worry about any sort of concurrency issues arising from shared memory inside the kernel again. But that's fine for two CPUs. What happens if you have 64 CPUs? That really doesn't scale very well. You're going to have to want the kernel to be running on multiple CPUs. So I thought the book does a good job of discussing all the mechanisms of locking. I'm not going to talk about locking just yet, but it does do a good job of talking about the mechanisms of locking. I don't think it does such a good job at discussing why this is a hard problem. And that's one thing I want to spend a bit of time talking. As it turns out, in modern systems, if you want to make sure you have exclusive access to some bit of memory, you need to have support from the CPU. You cannot implement it using regular instructions. You have to use special instructions to do this. So, why? Why can't I just use the regular code I've been using for everything else to do this? What's weird about this? So it's a little bit funny. So let's say we have a variable. Let's have a variable x. So x has got this. We'll have this value. Let's say it's 0. So x will be our lock variable. So when I'm running this code here, this is my critical. When I go into the critical section, I'll do a check of what I have here. Get lock, release lock. Let me
The idea being that one CPU will grab the lock. When it grabs a lock, then it will start running this code. And when it's done with that, it'll release it. So if another CPU comes in here and tries getting into the critical section, it'll see that the lock has already been taken. So since it's already taken, it won't run the critical section. It'll wait until the lock is available. And then it will release the lock. And then once the lock becomes available, which is when the other processor releases it, it will start running. So this is enforcing everyone taking turns. So the term for a variable that goes between 0 and 1 for things called a mutex, mutual exclusion, or a binary semaphore. Semaphores can have more, you can have semaphores with more than 0 and 1. A binary semaphore only has two values, 0 or 1. A semaphore actually comes from, I think, train. Think of mutual exclusion as the O train. How does the O train make sure that you don't have a head-on collision between two trains? Well, you'll notice that there's two trains. So the O train has two trains right now. It's supposed to go up to three, I believe, but there are two trains. They go from either end. There's one track here, and then there's this two-track thing right at Carleton. They pass each other, and they go past. But there's no technical reason in terms of things where one train can't be here, another train can't go here, go past Carleton, keep going, and boom. What you have to do is have this thing where you make sure that when they get to Carleton, they have to wait until the other train is passed. Once the other train is passed, then it can go on. Not next, but I believe the lights that control this sort of train crossing to make sure trains don't go on the same track. Signaling. Same basic machine. We don't want to have head-on collision in our critical section. In this part where we can only have one train there. Now my assertion, so what's the basic logic of this? It's kind of simple. It's if X equals 0, wait, else X equals 1, do stuff. That's the basic logic. So, really wait. Go. The logic of the semaphore is simple. Say, if it's 0, so.
About while 0.
Yeah, you can do it as a while zero. This is the unstructured version of actually in practice in assembly language you use GoTo. But basically the logic is you wait for the semaphore to be. Okay, I messed up that logic here. If X does not equal zero. That's right. If X does not equal zero. Then you wait. Once it's zero, then you go here. We start with the while loop. In practice, it actually doesn't matter because this code is wrong. This code, I don't care if you put it in a while loop, I don't care what you do with it. This code will not work unless you do some magic at the assembly language level. Why? Yes, there will be multiple critical points for a single program. Well, it depends. You could have, I mean, it depends on how fine a granularity you want in terms of parallelism. You could have lots. So the normal thing you do associating with lots is actually the thing that's critical is not the code, it's the data associated with it. So you really do locking on an object. So this object's got a lock. When you enter the object, only one CPU can execute code in that object at a time. That's kind of a classic thing. But as I was saying, this code is wrong. It will not work. If you do this, very bad things will happen. What if two CPUs gets this test at the same time? You're exactly right. So gets this test at the same time, they both see that it's zero, and they both go on to set it to be one.
But still in that case, the mutex operation has to be atomic.
That's the term, yes. That's why I'm going to back to get to.
But when you do the magic.
So this is the basic problem we have, is that when we're trying to test this variable, and when we're trying to set it, someone could have changed the value right from underneath us. That is the concurrency problem in a nutshell. With just a single variable, we have the concurrency problem. We normally think about concurrency issues with like, oh, I've got a tree, or I've got some other data structure. I don't have multiple CPUs access at the same time. In some way, they could corrupt the tree. You know, the pointers will be pointing all kinds of weird ways and stuff. But the problem comes down for a single bit. One bit, the smallest unit of storage we can do, we still have concurrency issues. Because I get two CPUs or more than one CPU can reach the test and see, is it zero? Oh, it's zero. I'm safe. And they both set it to one. Fail. And now both running the critical section at the same time, which is exactly what we did want them to do. So this is, yeah, now there are these software implementations that try to do this, there's some complicated logic, but the fact is, you can't do it reliably unless you have help from the hardware itself. And the help you have to have from the hardware is you have to combine this with this somehow. You can't have separate mechanisms. You can't do separately the testing operation and the changing operation. Those have to be somehow combined in one indivisible unit. And that's known as an atomic operation. Talk about things being atomic. It means that we're putting things together.
But we want something to execute as one indivisible thing. We shouldn't allow anyone on the outside to be able to split that apart. This is not atomic because it can be split apart.
So in order to do any sort of mutual exclusion, in order to have this work, we have to have something bind them together to be a single unit. We need them to be atomic. So what we actually have is we have special instructions on the CPU. The book goes into nice detail about the different kinds of things that do called test and set. So it makes literally these two operations as one instruction. Or there are these things where they swap two bytes. So you might have a variable here and another variable here, and you swap them. And the idea of swapping them is that if that's an atomic operation, you do the swap, and then you check to see what the value is. Because now you have the old value, and you have what the value was, and then you know what you set it to, because you know what went before the swap. So the book explains it. It does a pretty nice job of it. I'm not going to go into those in too much detail. But I think what's much more important rather than the mechanism is to understand why you have to revert to these hardware level tricks in order to get something that seems perfectly computable. And the fact is that yes, it's perfectly computable, but you don't have the hardware to do, combine these operations into an indivisible unit, the concurrency issue show up. So you can't do lock.
You might want to just go ahead and say, well, screw locks.
Yep.
There is such a thing as lock-free data structures. There are things where you have where you don't actually have to do any sort of locks because you never have issues of different processors or things accessing the same memory at the same time. Now, you can think about this. You know, how do you do that in general? It's actually pretty simple. You reserve, you make it so that every processor can only write to certain areas of memory. They never are allowed to write to the same memory. They can read each other's memory. They just can't write to each other's memory. As long as writes are exclusive to particular CPUs, you don't have concurrency issues. But that's a weird way of programming. But it's not a crazy way of programming. Because this is exactly what we do when we're talking about network computers. Can network computers directly change each other's memory? No. They, in effect, can access each other's memory in a read-only fashion by sending messages. You send data from one computer to another, it's a copy of its memory. And so you get your own copy, you can do whatever you want to that copy. It won't change the original. Everyone has exclusive access to their data. That's what network systems are. You don't have locks in distributed systems. But the concurrency problem doesn't go away. It changes to something different, which is instead of having one thing of shared memory, where you're trying to make sure all the accesses to that one bit of shared memory are consistent, you know, step on each other. Now you have separate bits of memory that you want to coordinate so that they have the same values. So the classic kind of operation. This is like, okay, you're connecting to a web server. Well, that's collecting to your email, Gmail. Let's say I connect to your Gmail account on one computer, and I've connected to the Gmail account on two computers. On one computer, I delete some messages. Do I see those deleted messages on the second computer? Well, if those both computers were talking, if both your web sessions were talking to the same computer, then it'd be like, okay, they're both talking to the same computer. One thing just changed the data structure. Okay, I see that the messages are actually gone. But that's not how systems like Gmail work. If one system is connected to your account on one computer, the other one, they're talking to different servers on Google. Almost certainly. You're talking to different computers, talking to different things. They might even be half a world away. Yet somehow Google has to make it seem that when you delete email on one computer, it actually is deleted on the other. And in fact, actually Google doesn't do this perfectly. If you start trying to have your Gmail account logged in different computers and watch, delete it in one and see when does it show up in the other one, it won't show up with you. It may take multiple seconds. It may take even minutes before it does it. Now, if you want to make sure that you get a consistent view, log out and log back in. When you log back in, you should see your messages actually being properly deleted. But if you have concurrent sessions, it won't necessarily. So messages are flying by, and if you want to learn about how this all works, that's my distributed operating system. That's not here. Here we're talking about single boxes. But I'm just saying that this locking problem that we're talking about only applies when you're sharing memory. If you're not sharing memory, you still have concurrency issues, but then it comes down to coordinating memory. Everything that was easy before becomes hard. Everything that was hard before becomes easy. Swap problems. So in practice, we actually have to do something. The hardware, the other thing I just want to say about why this is a hard problem is because of the memory hierarchy.
I know we talked about having registers. Registers, L1, L2, L3, RAM, and other storage.
RAM is big and slow, relatively speaking. Registers are really slow and small, but really, really fast. Data always moves between these. And the idea is you don't want to, you want to access things high up in the hierarchy as you can.
So, this is for CPU. Oh, let's say we have CPU 1. L1, L2, L3, RAM.
So let's say we have, let's say they both want to access address 2000. We access address 2000 on CPU 1. Where will it be? When we do the access, it'll originally address 2000 referring to an address in RAM. But it will be copied
into maybe L1. So we'll be in L1, and then it'll get copied into a register, and then it'll be written out here.
Now let's say CPU 0 now wants to read address 2000. Where is it going to go to get address 2000? It's going to go to RAM. So this is the same thing. These are not. So I've got a copy of address 2000 here. You might say, well, why don't you write it immediately back to RAM? Well, if I wrote it immediately back to RAM all the time, what's the point of having the cache? The point is I want to be able to do reads and writes to it in the L1 cache, and only when I'm done with it, write it back to RAM. That's how I make things fast. But if this CPU wants to read address 2000, if it reads it from RAM, it's going to get a stale copy because the current version is sitting in L1 on CPU 1. What's in RAM is an old version. Eventually, this will get written back to RAM, but this is asking for it now. So what does CPU 0 see when it accesses the address 2000? What would be the correct thing, and what would be the easy thing?
Correct would be a pointer to L1.
Yeah, correct would be somehow I would want to see exactly this. I would want to know this is here and keep that completely synchronized so we'd always see the same thing from both CPU.
Modern systems don't work like that, because if you start adding mechanisms like that, it slows things down. If you start having CPU 0 try to access addresses that CPU 1 is accessing directly, you're going to get stale data. You know, this is, if this was at 0, you're going to see the old value.
Why aren't L1 all shared between CPUs?
Why don't you share all the cache? Because that would be slower.
Sometimes you actually have shared, like L3. L3 might actually be shared, but L2 will be separate. It depends on the architecture of the system exactly how you're sharing. But sharing costs, because that means you have to have circuitry to allow access from multiple things. You have to now deal with, you know, concurrency issues there and stuff. It's more wires and everything. It's separate is faster. So on modern systems, you will get, in general, stale data if two CPUs try to, one CPU writes to a given memory address and the other one tries to read it basically immediately. It's not going to see the right value. The special instructions that have there are there. What they precisely do is they bypass the caches. They make sure that things are written to RAM, or if they do it in the caches, they say, hey, my cache looks like this. Update all your caches with this value for this address. They do some sort of broadcast method. This means that any of the instructions that are designed to enforce
atomicity, you know, that are atomic, are relatively slow. Not horribly slow, but you don't want to do most of your computation using that because they basically cause all the CPUs to talk to each other, to synchronize their state one way or the other. So you don't use them all. You don't write most of your code there. But when you need them, you really need them.
Is there a way to dedicate some of your code to one CPU? So you get to this section of the code, this CPU has to run it?
There's a really simple way to make sure that you don't have multiple problems. It's called writing your code in multiple processes. Don't share memory.
And in fact, older Unix systems didn't actually bother with multi-threaded processes. I mean, the kernel always has to deal with these issues. It always has to deal with shared, data structures being accessed by multiple CPUs. That's the nature of the OS. That's the abstraction it's providing for you.
That's why we talk about these concurrency issues traditionally in an operating system class,
because OSs were really the first concurrent programs. But if you can avoid it. Don't make your programs multi-threaded if you don't have to. Write them as multiple processes that communicate by messages. And the beautiful thing about writing them as multiple processes that communicate by messages is that they work the same if they're running on one box or running on 20 boxes. Or boxes separated by a network. Same semantics. So in modern systems, it's good. But sometimes it's faster if you can have, say, four CPUs all accessing the same memory, same data structures, and not having to copy data back and forth. Copying data is slow. So I'm not saying you can get away from this completely. I'm just saying is if you can avoid multi-threaded programs, do. We're going to go through a catalog of all the errors and things and stuff that come up. But right now here, I just want to give you a conceptual overview. So now I will take a 5-minute break. We're at 9:20, so we'll start up again at 9:25. Let's go and get started. So atomic operations, recurrency. Bit of terminology. What happens if you have let's say you mess this up. Let's say you don't have the locks in place to make sure your critical section is guarded. Now you have two CPUs, two threads, accessing the same memory at the same time. What is that called? That's known as a race condition. Race conditions arise when you haven't done your mutual exclusion properly. There's entire classes of security flaws, ways of breaking the systems, based on race conditions. And they're called races because it depends on the relative speed. It all depends on what happens with the program depends upon which part of the system is running faster or not. And it can vary from moment to moment. Maybe one time you run it, processor A is running faster. Next one, processor 0 is running faster. Processor 1 is running faster. Processor 2. The key idea to understand when you have a race condition is that the execution is indeterminate. Normally, we think of computers as deterministic systems. You give programs the same input, and they produce the same output. When you add in concurrency and you don't manage concurrency properly, you have race conditions, which makes the program indeterminate. I run it one time, I get one answer. Another time, I get another answer. This is not good. In principle, if you're trying to do a random number generator or something, you might think that this would be fine, but in practice, what happens with race conditions is actually most of the time it's deterministic. Most of the time it does the right thing. It's just every so often
it does a wrong thing. So the kind of systems where I worry about race conditions are things like the passenger elevator in Hertzberg. You've traveled in that. Have you ever noticed that elevator acts a little funny if everyone starts slamming the buttons in there? Like, it'll actually stop. Okay, it'll stop going, or like it'll do strange things if you press the buttons fast. If you press the buttons slowly, everyone presses it in nice order and presses it there, it works fine. And people start going bam, bang, 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 bang. It might just sit there. Just sort of sit there going, what? Maybe it starts going. It's just like, I am convinced there are race conditions in the code of that elevator. Because I don't think they do mutual exclusion properly in those controller systems. This is bad because you press them wrong way, you can cause the system to behave in strange ways. The normal case, when you press it slowly, there's a nice space between all the buttons you press, everything's fine. But if you do it wrong, bad things happen. Embedded systems that interact with the real world, tend to be concurrent in some way because they have to deal with real world events. People pressing buttons. And that's where the most dangerous race conditions come up. Have you ever heard of the Therac 25 incident? So this classically comes up in ethics classes in computer science. But it's worth talking about here briefly. So if you look at the Therac 25, this was a machine that was designed to give cancer patients radiation treatments. Now, okay, a machine that's going to irradiate you with radiation, that's kind of dangerous. And you might, and so how do these things work? Well, they have, generally most of the way you control the radiation that you get is through time. How long you're exposed to the source. And if it's exposed too long, you fry. So there's intensity settings and there's time settings. This is computer control. Now, what was funny is that an older version of the Therac, a previous model to the Therac 25, had hardware interlocks. To enforce the proper ordering of operations, they had hardware mechanisms to enforce things so that you couldn't give the patient too high of a dose, so it automatically shut off. So to save money, they said, that extra hardware is kind of expensive. So let's do those interlocks in software. And in fact, actually, when they had built the older one, they had done the interlocks in hardware and software. So they actually thought they already had the code to do everything properly. But they didn't. And in fact, Therac 25 had race conditions. Race conditions based on how the operator operated the machine, how fast they typed in the values, how fast they turned the dial, would change how the system behaved. To the point that the operators inadvertently killed some patients because of race conditions. Because they just turned the dial too fast. Something like that. And the interlocks there were no hardware interlocks, and the software didn't do proper mutual exclusion, and patients got too much radiation. So I'm going to say that the potential consequences, you see the same thing in your computers. You've probably seen when you log into Windows or start your computer, sometimes if you start typing things at the wrong time, you get things to freak out. You start clicking on things and like, oh, wow, I started running this and like this. And also, wait, crap. I'm doing operations I always do, but it's busy. Like, your system's busy doing something in the background. It's busy loading some other program or initializing or something. You start clicking on things and all of a sudden, weird things start happening. Not proper probably enforce mutual exclusion. Not, you know, it's just trying to do things in parallel, and they're interfering with each other somehow. And what you're classically happening is a race condition that would normally not happen on a system that was running at full speed, but is happening on a system that is being hacked. Because there's other things happening. There's more interrupts happening per second than you expect. So all this is to emphasize that the stuff we're talking about with concurrency is important and dangerous on every system. And the bugs show up in weird ways, and it's not a problem we have at all solved in general. And the reason we have not solved it at all in general is for the same reason we have not solved memory leaks perfectly. Because programmers are not perfect. We make mistakes.
And to do things, it may say, well, okay, this whole thing, okay, the key way to do this is to grab a lock when you enter a critical section and release the lock when you do it, and I always forget. Why don't you, programming language designer, why don't you make it easy for me? Make it so it's not possible for me to make this mistake.
Well, they have. In Java, they have a mechanism like this.
Conceptual term is called monitors, but the term in Java is synchronized. So you can have a synchronized object
that basically enforces mutual exclusion. It says that only one CPU can execute code in that object at a time. Great. Java's got it. Problem solved, right? If most code's not written in Java, if you're writing in C, you've got to do everything low level and some other languages. If you do this in.
Yeah, no, it just. These problems, we keep thinking we've solved them, and we still haven't solved them. So. There's various talk in. And of course, I'm saying that, okay, well, you have monitor. This is all fine here. This deals with the problem of race conditions when you have shared memory.
Remember I talked to you about having distributed systems with non-shared memory and having issues there? Well, you can have issues with concurrency in those distributed systems, very big one. And you can't solve them with monitors. Monitors assume shared memory. So race conditions don't go away even if you take steps to do things otherwise, because concurrency is everywhere. And it's only going to get worse. That's the worst part about this. I mean, I remember when I first started teaching this, I could kind of say, well, things are getting more concurrent and stuff like that. But now your phone has a quad-core processor, 4 or 8 core processor. You have GPUs with hundreds of, hundreds of thousands of computing elements. And you're regularly dealing, what do you program all the time? Cloud systems. Concurrency is everywhere.
I'm sorry. When I started off, it was much easier. It's not so easy. But just something to keep in mind. Long term, I think there's only one real way around this problem. It's simple. You enforce exclusive access to data by individual CPUs, and basically that means you get rid of side effects. What is programming without side effects? Have any of you taken 3007?
Yeah.
You're taking it now. Functional programming gets rid of most of concurrency errors. You program things functionally, you don't have to worry about this stuff.
Because you aren't accessing the same data at the same time. So whoever implements the functional language runtime has to worry about things, but you, as a developer, do not. And that's why, in fact, you start looking at large distributed systems, you start seeing functional programming ideas come in. So I don't know if you've talked about this in 3007, but pay attention. Those ideas are not going anywhere. In fact, are becoming more and more important. Sorry,
So in the tutorials, what you're going to see is there's these simulators, these x86 simulators. So all the work you spent on looking at assembly language is definitely not wasted, because you get to look at more. But this is simplified. The simulator does not do full x86 stuff. It just does a simplified version. But the instructions should look very familiar. But the idea of the simulator is that it shows you the execution of multiple threads at the same time. So you can I realize something. Do you all feel like you understand what I'm talking about when I say a thread? Because all I'm talking, when you're talking about threads, all we're talking about is different CPU contexts. So the state of all the registers, the thing that, that's what I mean by a thread. When you have a multi-threaded process, you have more than one context. An operating system kernel is inherently multi-threaded because it has to deal with lots of CPU contexts. It has to deal with the CPU context of each process and of its own state. We're dealing with different parts of it. But we don't normally talk about the kernel being quite multi-threaded, because threads are an abstraction that is provided by the operating system. When you write regular programs, you deal with threads. When you deal with the CPU, you have to deal with threads. When you deal with the operating system, you have to deal with the registers, pushing things on the stack, popping them off the stack, and doing all that. Because, of course, how do you share a CPU between multiple contexts? You have to save the context and load it again. OS. By default, your process has single threaded, so it means it gets one CPU. If you want your process to access more than one CPU at a time, same time, you have to make it a multi-threaded process. The thread is the way the OS gives you an abstraction for that.
So remember all the stuff we started talking with code here. We have the stack. We have heap. What happens when there's more than one CPU running around the same address? Code is normally read-only. So code's easy. You can, multiple CPU can run the same code, who cares? Not changing. In terms of data, we're talking about the heap and the stack. If you access things in the heap, that's your shared data structures. You probably want to have locks of some kind to enforce access to heap. So here, use locks. So every array, every object or something, you should probably have some sort of lock to protect it, to make sure that they aren't accessed by different CPUs at the same time. Here, locks for lock, read, locks, lock, read, data. You have three basic strategies for dealing with heap. One is you use locks to make sure everyone only accesses them one at a time. Another is have lock-free data structures, so that somehow you get, which means that you design the data structure so that different CPUs can access at the same time in some way. Or you partition the heap.
say every part of you just have the same, have certain memory. Now, the thing about partitioning the heap, you don't normally do partitioning the heap because, hey, if I can partition the heap, why don't I just have separate processes? Why do I need shared memory at all? I have a separate process, now it's all completely separate. So I have to deal with it. But the reason I wrote this up was because, what about the third part? The stack. What do we do with the stack when we have multiple threads? How do we share the stack? They each get their own stack. You don't share the stack. In fact, you could say the stack is the thing that kind of, that almost defines the state of the thread. Because it's what is what's used for you to keep track of, oh, I'm running code here. I've now jumped to this function. Where do I store where I was? I push it onto the stack. Where do I keep the arguments? I keep it there. The stack is where I keep the context for our current execution.
We have multiple.
Every thread gets their own stack. Because every thread will have its own local variables. Every thread will have its own return address. To be a multi-threaded process is to be a process that has multiple stacks. So, do you have to worry about doing any sort of locking on the stack? No. We've solved it with the partitioning. Instead of, we don't partition it, we partition the stack. And we share the heap. That's what you do with multi-threaded processes.
Mm-hmm. Forking causes a different thread, right?
A fork? No. A fork? That's a good question. There is when you run pthread create or something, create a new thread, it's actually called on Linux and a system called clone. Clone allows you to get more than one CPU state, but you share the address space. When you fork, you do not share the address space. You copy it. So when I fork a process, it's not that I have this, I logically say this, and I have a second copy of this. That's what a fork means. I duplicated memory. And now I have a new CPU context, everything for that separate one. It's a cloning operation. Clone version. Show it all. Gone into a transporter, and now you have two of them. Transporter. That's what you've got. Now, if you think about this for a second, you should realize fork, if it copies all of the memory of a process, that's a really expensive operation, right? So that seems like a really bad idea. So in fact, on older Unix systems, they actually, it was so expensive, they made variants of fork that were kind of cheaper. You had fork and you had vfork. Vfork had one basic purpose. It was for running children, child processes that would then do an exec v. That was the whole purpose of vfork. The idea with vfork is you don't bother copying the address space on fork because we're going to throw it away anyway and load and reinitialize the entire address space when we load a new binary. That's what exec v does. So why do that whole expensive copy operation and then throw it away? So instead you do a vfork, you don't do the copy. And then soon afterwards, you run the new executable. When you run the new executable in the new CPU context, you'll then get a new address space for it, but that will still start from scratch there, and then you'll process and run. But the semantics of this are a little weird, because vfork means child runs execve
then you get then the parent runs.
Which means that the parent does not run while the child is running in the parent's address space. Because remember, they're sharing the address space. The whole point was we didn't want to copy it. But we can't deal, if we start having concurrency in there, then all kinds of weird things happen. So in fact, what happens is the parent goes to sleep. You get a new CPU context. The child runs for a bit. It runs until it does execve. And then the parent resumes. So if the child messes up the address space of the parent will see it. So you have to make that code for the child be very careful and not have it mess things up. But nowadays,
forget about it. You don't use V4.
Is it because our systems are all slow now? No. It's because we figure out how to make forks fast. Forks on Linux systems are so fast that you actually don't care about trying to do this sort of thing. I just said, wait, copying all of memory, let's say it's a process with a gigabyte of RAM, stuff. Let's say it's got all kinds of things stored. If I do a fork, I logically have to copy a gigabyte of data. And I'm telling you now, it happens really fast.
What's the solution?
The trick is be lazy. The trick is laziness. Procrastination. So how can you procrastinate work? Only copy what you have to copy. We'll talk about how this works more later, but the basic strategy is you just mark all of memory as read-only. Say, wait, I can't write to anything now? Well, you mark all of its memory as read-only, and then whenever a write happens, you copy. You only copy memory when you write to it. As long as you don't write to it, you can share the memory. It's read-only. It's perfectly fine. Only when you write to it, you copy it. So you have these two processes now that logically are just copies of each other, but in practice, they share most of their memory. They only have duplicates for the pages that they've individually written to. And if either one writes to it, then you make a copy of it. And now they're separated. So,
a lot of bookkeeping that happens. But the thing I think I want to end on for you thinking about this is thinking about how this all interacts with this concurrency stuff. So, given the fact that fork is cheap, that you can duplicate an entire address space very quickly because you don't actually copy it. You just copy it as you need to later down the line. There isn't that much difference between running multiple threads in terms of overhead in a given address space and running separate processes. So when do you want to have multiple threads? What is the basic use case for that? It's not for doing having things run on multiple CPUs. We can do that by running multiple processes. Why bother creating a process with multiple threads? Why deal with all this?
Oh, so you could type in one sense and then the other thread can read from hard drive or something.
There's two basic reasons to have threads. One is shared data. Or two, IO. So let's say you've got a really large data structure that you want to do lots of computation on. You can't do computation on all with one CPU. You want to do computation on it with 16 CPUs.
you have to deal with concurrency issues. You have to potentially maybe do some locking, or you have to make it a lock-free data structure, or do something or other. But I want 16 CPUs to all access that same data at the same time. Then you want to share that memory. Then, yeah, go ahead and make it a multi-threaded process. It's going to be harder, but that, you know, you're going to get 16 processors to work on your problem at the same time. But the more common case is for I/O.
So what do I mean by I/O?
I mean, on, oh, here's a simple illustration. On older Macintosh systems, when you would want to, this is before Mac OS 10, so Mac OS 9, 8, 7, go on. If you were holding down the mouse button, held it down for a long time, the computer would drop packets coming in over the network. Nothing would happen on the computer while you held that mouse down. It literally would stop the computer from anything. Except when you could scroll the mouse, I think, but nothing else happened. In general, do you want your computer to be doing computations? Like, do you want it to keep rendering that web page while you scroll it through it? Yes. You don't want that all of a sudden, oh, I'm scrolling. It just froze, and then we let go. Now it starts rendering again. Is that how you want your computer? No. You want it to do more than one thing. But if you think about that case of the web page, scrolling that web page, you would say one thread has to deal with, someone has to be paying attention to all the events happening from you interacting with your mouse. It has to pay attention to it, and it has to be doing things. Another thread's got to be, someone else has to be dealing with rendering the page, to do the work of making the page show. Another thread has to be dealing with the network. Data's coming in from there, maybe keeping that in for getting ready for rendering. Web browsers are highly concurrent systems, and they are all multi-threaded to some degree. Modern browsers are also highly use multiple processes in order to increase security. Older browsers was all in one process. And by being all in one process, you could do all this at the same time, but that means if any one of them messed up, they corrupted memory for all of it, and now everything's shot to hell. Modern browsers, you know, starting with Chrome, but increasingly Firefox and IE, split it up into multiple processes so they don't share memory. So if you mess things up in one, then you have no one's okay. So you ever seen Chrome say, oh, snap? What happened with oh, snap? A process crash. Does Firefox, at least older versions of Firefox, did they ever go, oh, snap? They crashed. The entire browser crashed because it was all in one process. Firefox increasingly, though, is isolating things in process. You don't see more of those things in Firefox. There are certain architectural issues. They can't do that with their extensions, but they're working on it. But Chrome, they separate into multiple processes, so that corruption in one doesn't affect the others. Now you might go say, well then how does it have them all communicate? How do you do the scrolling and things? Turns out the architecture of Chrome is a bit complicated. Some things have to be shared. But this is the basic issue, is that you want things to be, the main use case for multi-threaded applications is for making I/O
happen, for making nice, smoothly interactive applications. And I'm over time. I'll better stop there.